We'll see how we go. So I'm going to try and, so I suggested this, that I could give something on this topic because of the, I think it fits very well to the theme of this program, because I think of all of the areas of, if you like, if quantum information is contributes something new to physics, then the new ingredient it brought in was taking ideas from computer science into physics. You know, that's not all of quantum information does that, but like a core of quantum information is somehow is this merging of computer science and physics. And this topic in particular of Hamiltonian complexity is kind of perhaps one of the best examples of how computer science ideas have given us new insights into physics. So hopefully physics questions that you guys, you know, physicists, once upon a time I was a physicist, I guess I call myself a lapsed physicist now. But you know, we're really interested in as physicists, that we get some new insight from computer science. So hopefully I can sort of give you a crash course in kind of an overview of this topic, and convince you that you know, we learned something new from thinking about many-body quantum physics from a computer science kind of mindset. So I'm going to spend the first half hour-ish, maybe long, we'll see how many questions you ask me. I'm assuming that probably everyone knows more, is sort of more comfortable with physics and maybe less from computer science. And Fernando asked me to keep this sort of very, really start from a low level. So I'm going to start by probably insulting your intelligence, but really just starting from zero in complexity theory, and spend about half an hour covering basics of that, then talk about the Hamiltonian complexity and how those complexity theory ideas, how they got used in studying many-body quantum systems. And if that's all I get to, that's fine. And I'm going to, since given time constraints, I'm going to at most get very, very high level some of the proofs, but probably not even, I mean, really mostly just focus on explaining what results we have. And if there's still time left over, I'll try and explain where the field's got to, you know, where, bring you up to date with where we are right now. And in the last, I guess, in the last decade, there's been a lot of work on this in this area. So we'll see. So, but please do stop me if I don't get to the last part, that's fine. I'm going to omit most details, but if you want more details, there's a set of lecture notes on my website, which I'm basically using as the basis for this and skipping most of. But for many more details, if you go to that page, you'll find many more details, including all the proofs and all the rigorous details and a lot more background. There are also some very nice, but before you go to that, the better thing to look for, that's easy to get to because it's online. The better reference is the book by Kitaev, Chien, and Viali. No, I can never spell it. I think that's a Y. From about 2000, it's called Quantum Computations in the title. So this would, I would go to as a first reference, but if you can't get hold of that book and it's sometimes out of print, you can go to there, you can find the lecture notes. There's also some nice review articles, and if you look up Hamilcar, you'll find at least two very nice review articles by Dorit Aharonov and others, and Zef Landau. Okay, so let me start by telling you, by giving a kind of brief introduction to complexity theory. So, complexity theory is classifies computational problems according to how many resources you need to solve them, or more precisely, how the resources scale as the problem gets more and more difficult, as the problem gets larger in some sense. So the resource we're going to be interested in for the whole of today is time. You can also think about complexity into the space resources or memory resources required for computation, but a lot of complexity classes concern time. And the most famous one is, well, not the most famous one, but at least perhaps the most important one is the class P, which stands for polynomial time. So this is the class of problems that can be solved in a time polynomial in the problem size. So technically it's decision problems, so solvable in polynomial time. And what's the polynomial in? Polynomial is in the number of bits required to specify an instance of the problem. So an example of this would be, for example, multiplying two numbers together. Okay, although that's, so then the size of the problem is the number of bits I need to write down to specify those two integers, and then the complexity, the time is the time required for the algorithm, the number of time steps required for it to multiply those two numbers. Except that that wouldn't be an example of a decision problem. A decision problem is just, it has a yes-no answer. And a lot of complexity theory is formulated in terms of decision problems, so problems with yes-no answers, just because the theory is cleaner and nicer. And generally, it doesn't matter a great deal whether you restrict. This restriction is often not very important, because for any problem where you want to actually solve something, like multiplying two numbers, you can always turn it into an equivalent decision problem, or equivalent in the complexity theoretic sense. So, for example, I could, instead of saying, can I, you know, what's the product of these two numbers, I could ask, is the product of these two numbers bigger than k? That would turn that into a decision problem. That would then fit this definition. It's either yes or no. But now if I want to figure out what the product is, I can just do a binary search. I just say, okay, is it bigger than 3? Is it bigger than 12? And typically that only requires a logarithmic overhead to then pin down the actual value. This is not always true, but generally for most of the problems we're interested in. And so then, because we care about how, you know, we only care about, does it run in, can we solve it in polynomial time? A logarithmic overhead doesn't really make any difference to how complex the problem is. Okay, so there's some subtleties, but okay, the definition of P is problems you can solve on a computer in reasonable time. So, yeah.
So if you have a some physical system which you want to evolve and ask whether it does something or something else, the size of the problem would be both specifying the initial state, accurately enough, and the dynamics, the full Hamiltonian.
If your problem was, can you compute the dynamics of this Hamiltonian, and I mean, if I measure this spin, is it up, for example, would be a decision problem, then yes. So the problem would, the size of the problem would be all of the bits of information I need to specify the initial state, all of the information I need to specify the Hamiltonian, and then the problem would, and then one way to solve it would be to time evolve. Of course, it's a quantum Hamiltonian. This is a classical class. I should have specified that. So this is on classical computation. But yes, yeah. Exactly what the size of the problem is depends on what model of computation I'm using. So, but you know, if I'm using, I'm not going to go into any details about models of computation. If I'm think of a circuit, it's the number of bits that going through the circuit. If you're thinking of computation in terms of Turing machines, it's the number of symbols you have to write on a tape at the start.
But I mean, the rules vary a little bit depending on whether you acknowledge that you know the Hamiltonian or.
So at the moment I'm talking really, I will get to Hamiltonians later, but really just think about...
Even classically specifying the dynamics versus knowing them already from the start.
I'm not sure I get your question.
Just a simple classical system, or maybe even more complicated classical systems on how will a box of gas evolve for that you would have to specify quite a lot of detail, not about just the initial state, but also... conceivably about what sort of interactions you might have and so forth. So depending on whether you think that you know the interactions or sort of have to specify them in detail, it sounds like the size of the problem will be very different.
But then you're asking, I mean, that's because then that's a different, it depends on what the problem is you're asking, right? So however much information you need, just write down, here's all the details you need, now here's a question about that. The problem size is just defined to be however many bits of information you need to specify the instance. Whether that's more or less, if you want to ask more accurate questions, those are different problems. Okay, so perhaps the most famous complexity class, and the one that perhaps is the first thing that you need to get your head around conceptually, is the class NP, which doesn't stand for non-polynomial. It stands for non-deterministic polynomial. But this name is, I would ignore... kind of historical non-deterministic polynomial time, but this name is somehow archaic. There's the modern view of NP has nothing to do with this name, so I will explain the kind of the best way to think about it and the way that we think about it in complexity theory these days. So NP is the class of problems that are solvable, we don't know, they may be solvable easily, they may not be, we don't care, that's not part of the definition. They're the class of problems where you can check the answer efficiently. Efficiently means, again, in polynomial time. So what? Before I write down the definition, let me give you an example of a problem that's in NP. There's a problem that you, I'm sure, know, have heard of, the factoring problem. I give you as input a number, integer, n. we can think of the size of the problem as the number of digits in this integer. Maybe better to think of it as a number of digits in binary, as a binary number. Okay, then input that, and the output. And let's make it a decision problem. So an integer n and an integers n and k. And then the output is, we want output should be yes if n has a factor smaller than k. And otherwise, no. Okay, so this is an example of a okay, let me just simplify things. Let's not make a decision problem. Let's just have output factors of k. And we could make it into a decision problem if we wanted to. Factors of n. Okay. So there's a problem that if we could solve it efficiently, or if I could solve this efficiently, I could steal all of your credit card credentials off Amazon and order a lot of things cheaply over the internet, because all of crypto on the internet is based on this problem being hard, which we don't have a proof of, but as far as we know, we don't have a better algorithm for this than is it divisible by 2, is it divisible by 3, is it divisible by 5, etc. However, if I give you the factors of a number and say, here's the answer, it's very easy to multiply them together and check if I'm lying or not. Okay? So that is a good problem to keep in mind when thinking about NP as a kind of classic problem that has a kind of the structure of NP. It's very easy to check if the answer is, if you're given the answer by someone, then you can reasonably check if they're lying or not. But it may or may not be easy to actually solve the problem and find the answer in the first place. So that's the modern view of NP, or the modern definition even, is to view this as a game between, as a prover and a verifier. So the prover somehow comes up with the answer, or some putative answer to the problem, and the verifier's task is to detect whether the prover is being honest or not. Are they giving me the real factors, or are they claiming here are the factors and lying? And the definition of NP is that it should be easy for the verifier to check answers. So let me problems about Hamiltonians is one good example, but we'll come to that later. So, let's see. Right. Okay, so class of again principle yes/no problems. And where for which there exists a polynomial time verifier such that, so the verifier should be able to check answers. So if we have a yes instance of the problem, the answer is yes, I could turn this into a decision problem saying, okay, is there a factors less than k? Yes, then for yes instances of the problem, if the answer is yes, then there should be exist a polynomial sized witness, so called. Right. Something that, for example, think the witness for the factoring problem would be the factors. So if I'm given those, then the verifier should output 1 or yes. And in the no instance, there should be that for all witnesses, if I run the verifier, then the output will be 0, so it rejects it. So in other words, if it's a yes instance, then the prover should be able to give me a proof, and I should be able to check it efficiently. If it's a no instance, then the prover shouldn't be able to trick me into believing it's a yes instance. So if I took the factor and said, okay, is there a... if I was factoring... if the number was prime and the prover tried to give me some factors of the prime number, I should be able to run an efficient check, so I just multiply the factors together and I can see quickly that he's lying. So that means that there's nothing he can give me that will convince me that the answer is yes, the number can be factorized, if it can't. Okay, so that's just formalizing this. But so I think factoring is a good problem to keep in mind here as kind of quintessential NP problem. Okay, so you can think of this as, think of NP as a game between two players. There's a, and one way to think about this, these are often called in complexity theory Merlin and Arthur. Merlin's an all-powerful wizard that can somehow magically come up with answers to problems, but he's not trustworthy. And Arthur is, you know, a nice guy, but he's limited by polynomial time computation. So he wants to check that what he goes to Merlin for to solve some problem. Merlin gives him an answer. He wants to check that what Merlin tells him is not lying. Okay. Good. So far, what I've talked about here is deterministic computation. Everything is just like on the computers we have on our desktop. We can generalize this a bit, and this is going to be important as we go towards quantum computing and quantum complexity theory. That we can also introduce randomness probabilistic computation. So there are probabilistic analogs of P and NP. These are called BPP, is the probabilistic analog of, I think of this as probabilistic P. Stands for bounded error probabilistic polynomial time. These are the same as P. So things we can efficiently solve, but the answer only needs to be correct with probability 2/3. Okay, and this is as for P, but now we allow the computer to flip coins during the computation, and so it's what it does can be dependent on some random bits. Okay, so I guess I should say but allow sampling random coins. Bits, and the answer only needs to be correct with probability 2/3. Okay, this 2/3 is completely arbitrary. I could have made it 9/10 or anything bounded away from 1/2, for the simple reason that if I want to get more certainty about the answer, I can just run the computation again and again. And a simple application of Chebyshev's inequality, you can show that with only polynomial number of repetitions, I get exponentially close to 1 in probability. So I run the computation multiple times and take the majority vote over the outcomes, for example.
The answer is still yes, no.
The answer is still yes, no here, yeah. So that's a good point. So as for P, so again, formally these are decision problems, as I said before. Usually that's not much limitation. You can pretty turn most problems you're interested in into a decision problem that's equivalent. Okay, so 2/3 is conventional but arbitrary. I could take anything bounded away from 1/2. Yeah. Okay. Then the probabilistic version of NP is actually called MA, and it stands for Merlin Arthur. And those problems, so again, it's as for NP. So again, we have its decision problems. But now, the Arthur's computation can now be probabilistic polynomial time, so he's allowed to sample random bits during the computation if he wants to. And now the witness verifier computation, so when he's checking the answer, he needs to succeed in checking it only with probability 2/3. But so allow randomness, random bits, and now for yes instances there should exist a witness, poly-sized witness, W, such that V of W equals 1 with probability bigger than 2/3. So that's if the answer is yes. And for no instances, the same analogous change. So then exists a polynomial size witness, V of W should equal 0 with probability to at least 2/3. Again, the 2/3 is arbitrary, it is just convention. I could make this anything bounded away from 1/2, and by just repeating the computation a polynomial number of times, I can amplify this probability exponentially close to 1 with only probability effort. BPP is usually conceived, or is often thought of as the class of problems that you can solve efficiently on a classical computer, because we can sample random bits on a classical computer. At least we have sources of random bits on the computer, whether they're correct or not, who knows. But and the fact that we only require the answer to be correct probabilistically, once you amplify this up to something exponentially close to 1, chances are a cosmic ray will have flipped a bit in your computation anyway. So getting probability one is not actually happening on our computers anyway, even with a deterministic computation. There's always some chance that cosmic ray comes in and flips the bit just before you read it. There's nothing you can do about that. So once you amplify this probability up to something close to one, this is really capturing what you really want from a real computer. So somehow this is usually conceived of in complexity theory as the class of problems that can be solved on a classical computer. Okay, so there are some famous Weeb open problems about these complexity classes, and they're the most famous problem in complexity theory. It's one of the Millennium Prize problems, is whether P is equal to NP or not. So like, I guess I should write this here. Is P, is the class of problems that we can check the answers efficiently the same as the problems that we can solve efficiently? It's hard to say what I guess the general consensus is no, that these are different classes, although you can find complexity theorists arguing that these should be the same. But I think it's fair to say the general consensus is that these classes are different, but there are sort of new proofs, attempts at proofs every so often. There was one a few weeks ago on the archive. Again, it seems like there's a mistake, a flaw in the proof. And there are lots of results showing that this is a difficult problem to solve. There's many techniques, there's results showing that many sophisticated techniques are ruling out a lot of techniques for trying to separate these two classes. P not equal to NP somehow aligns with our everyday experience. It's easier to check a solution than it is to find the solution in the first place.
Can I ask a naive question? Yep. Where do undecidable propositions in mathematics fit into this?
Okay, that's a very good that's a good question. So this board is readable to everyone. Let me draw a diagram of the complexity classes. So this is going to be the kind of consensus view of what the complexity classes probably look like, what the hierarchy looks like. So we have P here. We have NP. And we have BPP. And MA, some probabilistic versions. So in some sense, you can think of decidable problems as a huge complexity class that's really outside of all of this, plus a gazillion other classes that I haven't written down here. So these would be all of the decidable problems. So decidable problems, problems where we don't even care about how long it takes to solve the problem. We just say, can we solve it at all, given as much time as you want, as much memory as you want. Okay, so all of these problems are decidable, even the ones in NP. Because one thing we could do is for example, just from the definition, we know there is a way of solving these problems. We just check all possible witnesses. We just enumerate them one by one and check them. It'll be a very slow process. It'll take exponential time, but it would find the witness eventually. And you know, we test each possible factors. So the naive algorithm for factoring is doing exactly that. We test all possible factors one by one. Eventually, we'll get there.
But the other ones are not probabilistic.
You can. You have to enumerate over all possible values of the random bits. Again, that's not something you can do efficiently, but for decidable problems, you don't care about the efficiency.
Yeah. The undecidable are outside the...
Exactly. So undecidable problems are not solvable regardless of however many resources you have. Traditionally, this is considered a slightly different field. This is computability theory, which is really about what can be computed and what can't, whereas complexity theory is a resource-limited version of that, where you ask, can it be solved with restrictions on the resources? But you can see class of decidable problems as a big complexity class that has everything else inside it. Yeah.
Is the BPP equal to MA?
It's also open. It's slightly less. You don't get $1 million for it. It's not a Millennium Prize problem, but it will be as remarkable as it is. Just is open. It's you'd get probably as much fame in complexity in computer science for solving that.
And the two are logically distinct.
As far as we know, logically distinct.
Does physics realize each of these classes? Because I think it doesn't realize all the undecidable problems for interesting reasons.
Right, so for complexity class, yes, because you're talking about if you are prepared to allow it to run for an exponent or a very long time, where you don't care about how long, eventually, you know, you can
always realize this in a physical system.
Yes. With a certain, caveat that it's not clear whether it's, perhaps you really want, could make a strong argument that you really need to go to probabilistic classes, because you don't have anything perfectly in physics. You've always got some noise or some things that are not known to infinite precision.
The example I have in mind is topology, which in high enough dimension is undecidable, but physics allows topology to change, so it's not actually a well-defined thing.
I mean, you have to formulate the problem as a computational problem, which isn't always, which really means, okay, here's the number of bits that I need to specify the input of the problem, here's the output. You have complexity classes that are not just decision problems. Those are just functional problems where you ask, what are the factors? But you formulate the problem as a computational problem, then you can start asking questions about it. So often a first step, which is not always the... So, sometimes it's not the... capturing the right notion of what a sort of formal computational version of a physics problem is, there are some subtleties. For example, usually physics problems are over real numbers or involve calculus. A real number needs infinitely many bits to specify, so the problem size is already infinite before you start, which makes no sense. So you have to get, okay, it's got to be real numbers up to some precision, or you've got to go, okay, I'm going to do it over the rationals. There's some subtleties but
are there subtleties that you don't really have asymptotic, the luxury of probing the asymptopia in physics? You don't have infinite size of the problem in some realistic sense.
Right, so for complexity theory that's great, because then that says, okay, we're only asking about the problem on some finite number of particles, and then that's a good fit to complexity theory. If you start asking about problems about the thermodynamic limits, then you can end up out here. Yeah, sure.
Sorry if I missed it. So between BPP and P, there's separation?
Good question. So there's a sort of theme here. There are results in complexity theory, okay? It's not all open problems, but what you just specified is another open problem. Is P equal to BPP? Unknown. That's called the de-randomization conjecture. The consensus here is probably yes.
So why can't you use a pseudo-random number generator?
Well, that's why the conjecture is probably yes, these are equal. But you have to prove that a pseudo-random generator is of course not actually random. If in polynomial time you can detect that it's not truly random, this is false. The conjecture is there are pseudo-random number generators whose statistics are indistinguishable from true random numbers within a polynomial time computation. If that conjecture is true, P is equal to BPP. Okay, but that's, again, you don't win $1 million for that, but that's almost pretty much as famous a problem in complexity theory as the other ones on the board.
I just wanted to make sure I understand. When you say that these complexity classes exist in physics, you mean that you can set up something that, in principle, if allowed to run for an exponentially long amount of time, would eventually solve a problem that's in one of these characteristic classes, not that you can... necessarily find instances in physics that will always contain encoded within them the solution to specific hard instances of these.
I'm not sure what it means for complexity classes to exist in physics, but here's my kind of physics take on. And I think
trying to understand your answer to this question.
I'm not sure I understand my answer to that question. But I think here's probably Alan Turing's view. I think would be that computation is really something that can be done in the real world. So his model of computation, which started the whole field of theoretical computer science, of Turing machines, was something very physical. It really has a head, it has a tape, the thing moves along and writes symbols. This is something you can actually build, and people have, people have built Turing machines out of Lego. The idealized model has an infinitely long tape. But even that you can approximate or pretty well physically by every time it reaches the end of the tape and needs more tape, you stick on an extra bit. It's an idealized model of physics, but so are all of our models of physics. I wrote down a Hamiltonian, that's an idealized model of a physical system. I think Turing's answer would have been that he viewed computation really as something physical, and his model of computation that is equivalent to all of the other models that I could write down is really something very physical. So in that sense, computation does happen in physics. For example, the chip in my laptop is a physical device. It has electrons flying around, and it carries out computation. So I think this is an idealization of things that happen in real world, the same as any other theoretical physics model is a mathematical idealization of the physics. In that sense, computation is definitely something physical. The other side of the problem of what do physics problems look like in this, I'm hoping, I will get to before the next hour is up, and you'll see an example of a problem in quantum mechanics that formalizes a decision as a computational problem, and we'll see what that the complexity theory can tell us about it in quantum physics. So to get there, I need to finish off this by defining the quantum versions of these classes. And this by now, this is kind of, if you've wrapped your head around these, then you've essentially understood everything. This is where you have an advantage over the computer scientists, because quantum, as soon as you put quantum in, computer scientists get a little bit worried because they don't learn quantum mechanics as an undergraduate. This is where this will be much easier for this audience, in that, so BQP, bounded error quantum polynomial, or quantum P if you like. Things will be solved in polynomial time on a quantum computer. All of these were classical. Okay, so I'm not gonna pin down exactly what I mean by a quantum computer, but think, hopefully all of you are at least sort of familiar with the idea you can have a quantum circuit. If not, I think some who would like, if I say quantum circuit, who knows what I'm talking about and doesn't want me to explain it? Not quite everyone. Good. I asked it that way around, so it wasn't embarrassing to not put your hand up. So think of a quantum circuit like this. I have some two-dimensional systems, so spin, let me write this. I can call this Hilbert space C2, or I can call it a qubit, or I can call it a spin half particle. All of those are the same thing. So each of these lines represents a spin half particle. This is time flowing in this direction. And a quantum circuit looks like this. Right. This is a unitary operation. So think of these things, these qubits flowing through from left to right. As they go through this box, they have this unitary applied to them. So this is a unitary on two qubits. In other words, this is a 4x4 unitary matrix that gets applied to that. Okay, so this is a discrete time dynamics. And here's another one. And maybe we have some single qubit unitaries. And in fact, it's enough to just take one and two qubit unitaries. And then what's the output of my computation? I measure. So measure the output in the 0-1 basis or the up-down basis. That's a model of quantum computation. Then polynomial size, up to some subtleties which I'm going to sweep under the carpet, is if it can be solved on a quantum computer in polynomial time, it means that there is a polynomial size circuit for solving the problem. And, of course, quantum mechanics is something inherently probabilistic. If I do this measurement, I mean, this is not guaranteed to be in the standard basis. It could be, for example, it could be in the x direction, the spin, the superposition of 0, 1. So this measurement is inherently probabilistic. So this is a generalization of BPP. We require the answer to be correct, correct answer with probability bigger than 2/3. And the most important complexity class for all of the rest of the talk is the quantum generalization of MA, which is called QMA. And this is the quantum analog of MA. So now everything, same as for MA, but now, so again, I only require Arthur to be able to verify things with, I mean, his verification has to be correct with probability at least 2/3. But now Alpha now has a quantum computer at his disposal. But Alpha has a quantum computer. So it has a polynomial time quantum computation. So this captures the class of problems that can be solved efficiently on a quantum computer. This captures the class of problems where the solution can be verified efficiently on a quantum computer. Okay. It may not be complete. If you may be worried about whether this is really a generalization of, or does this really include BPP, for example, because, of course, if we've got unitary dynamics, this computation is reversible, right? Whereas I didn't say anything about this doesn't have to be reversible classical computation. But thanks to work by Charlie Bennett and others and Toffoli and others in the late 1970s, we know that classical computation can be made reversible. without losing anything in terms of what you can compute and the efficiency. So indeed, quantum computation really is a generalization of includes classical computation as a special case. So it is in fact true. So if I finish this picture, this is where it gets tricky. So there's the class BQP. We don't know if it's
not in M8, right?
It's not in M8, thanks. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, not known. Right. I thought I misread. That's QMA. Thanks, Fernando. So there we go. BQP. Most of these, this is representing. We don't really know how it sits in, but we know it contains P. And other than that, what we know is that it's contained in QMA. And how these classes sit together, again, all open problems. Whether BQP is equal to BPP is the question of, is quantum computation useful for anything? Open problem. I mean, we have, the conjecture is yes. For example, factoring, not known to be solvable in polytime, but of course famously is solvable in quantum polynomial time by Shor's algorithm. But it could be the factorings in P anyway. We don't know. And so it could be that BQP is in P, is equal to P. And same QMA versus MA and QMA versus BQP, all of these are open problems. Okay, are there any questions at this point? Yeah?
The randomness of BQP is not, there's no random error or anything like that.
The randomness of BPP is not a pseudo-random denominator either. These are genuinely genuine random bits. It's an extra resource I'm giving the computer.
Wait, you said something earlier about if you can prove...
If there are good pseudo-random number generators, then I don't need the random bits. I could simulate them with a pseudo-random number generator. But that's an open problem. We don't know if that's possible. Because it could be that any pseudo-random generator, I mean, we know all pseudo-random number generators are faulty. With enough computational time, if I've got a polynomial time pseudo-random number generator, I can actually distinguish it from a genuine randomness. So it could be that, and it could be that, that actually with polynomial time computation is enough to show, to detect that a pseudo-random generator is actually pseudo-random rather than genuinely random. Open problem, we don't know. Conjecture is that that's not possible. There are good pseudo-random random number generators, and I could, BPP, I could just erase and fold it into P. But we don't know that. So that's important here, that there really is, I mean, this is really random classical computation. We have random bits available to the computer. Quantumly, we don't need to add that as an extra thing, because we can get random bits just by taking something in equal superposition of 0 and 1 and measuring it. So we have the randomness is built in to quantum mechanics already.
What's an example of a problem which is in MA and can be solved using BPP, but it's not in MP? So it's
I don't know of one, and it may be that we don't know. I think that's, yeah.
Can I ask one more?
Well, unless you take factoring, which is, of course, factoring is in NP, so it's also in MA.
No, I wonder something outside.
Yeah, outside of MA. Then I don't have an example for you, and I'm not sure that we know of any good candidates.
Maybe slightly more general question about this whole diagram. Mm-hmm. There exist problems, I think, where you have some tuning parameter where you can cause phase transition from one class to another.
Yes.
So, what is known about the, so this is like you're talking about phases or whatever, but what is known about the phase transitions? Are they second order in some sense, or are they, which of these transitions?
So, where that's been studied a lot is in satisfiability problems, which maybe I should have given as an example. So, erasing some stuff. So I had factoring as an example. Another good example of an NP problem is SAT, where I have input a Boolean formula, or more formally a bit string specifying all of the Boolean operations in the formula and how many variables there are. Output yes if there's a satisfying assignment to this formula. In other words, there's an assignment to the variables in this formula that such that the formula evaluates to true and no otherwise. That's a problem where this kind of phase transitions between easy and hard instances have been studied. In the context of random SAT instances, we take a Erdős-Rényi random graph, say, and we put Boolean constraints at random, pick a random set of Boolean constraints, as you increase the density of the number of constraints, and this is, of course, very close to a classical Hamiltonian problem. Right? Then, at low density, the problem is in P, and at high enough density, it seems to be hard and is in NP, and there is I don't know whether I think or at least so that's not quite true. So the at low densities it's in P. There's basically satisfying assignments. At very high densities it's in P as well, because there are no satisfying assignments and it's easy to detect that. It's at the intermediate regime when you're at the phase transition, it seems to become hard and there isn't an efficient way to solve that instant problem. And that conjecture is that then those will be the problems that are hard instances will be NMP. There is a proof, not that long ago, by Naor and others, that this is genuinely a phase transition.
And they are similar analogs, quantum versions of?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so exactly that random quantum sat problem, where now my constraints are a sort of random local Hamiltonian, by Julia Kempe and others, or Kempe, Dorita Haranov, and other authors. Yeah, have done. The results are slightly weaker there in the sense that we've got a good idea of where this, in terms of the density of constraints, where the transition occurs classically. We know it to within kind of scaling at least of it. And quantum mechanically there's a bigger gap for that. It's not quite known as well.
But when it comes to applying this to physics, aside from just giving up on the problems if you prove it too hard, is the idea, positively to prove no-go theorems or prove that certain physical processes will take a long time to find a ground state or do some other dynamics.
My take on it would be that. I mean, it tells us something about the physics. It's not just saying give up on these problems. It tells us, so for example, even just classically with the classical problems, and this was studied a lot in the 80s of these kind of sat and the connections between this and classical statistical mechanics problems and spin glasses. If you have an NP hard instance, you expect that if you do any physical process you do, according to the Church-Turing thesis, any reasonable model of computation is equivalent to all of the others. One reasonable model of computation is take a system and I cool it down, because it's something I can do physically, so that seems a good definition of reasonable. And if that Church-Turing thesis is correct, then these NP-hard instances, and if it's true that NP-hard instances aren't equal to P, so modulo all of these conjectures, if I take the system and cool it down, that's a reasonable way of doing computation, but if it's an NP problem, we expect that it can't be done efficiently. So that must mean that the system is displaying kind of glassy dynamics. It's going to get stuck in a metastable state for a long time. But this gives us a different, completely different angle on showing that things are behaviors, have spin glass-like behavior. So my take on it will be this is telling us something about the physics. It's not just saying give up on these problems. It's, we don't give up on studying spin glasses. On the contrary, they're very interesting physical systems.
There's a great history of no-go theorems in physics. They're hard to really prove without extra assumptions.
Right. So, I mean, the downside is that you're often relying on something like this, P not being equal to MP for all of this to be held. It gives you a different angle on these systems, which I think you learn something new from.
So, two things. One, to respond to the question that Eva just asked, I guess the case in that this appears in the stuff that we work in is it's kind of what the Harlow-Hayden statement about firewalls is like, right? They show that like one of the tasks you need to do in order to perform the next experiment is in some high complexity class. And they argue that it's difficult to say that you can finish performing that task before the black hole completely evaporates. So that is kind of like a no-go-ish result in this way.
And it is a sort of based on a kind of this kind of thinking of complexity theory thinking. But that's because Patrick works in quantum information, so he knows he has that. He's been infected with that mindset.
It's been argued back.
But like that's. I'm just saying it's an example of this kind of thinking. The other question that I had that might make a little bit less sense. So P is related to BPP by this de-randomization conjecture.
Yeah.
What is the analogous class if one exists that's related to BQP by de-randomization?
There isn't a very good. You can define exact quantum computation to be the quantum analog of P rather than the BPP, but it's not a very natural class because quantum mechanics is inherently probabilistic. As soon as you measure something and you're not measuring in the same basis as the state you're measuring, you've got a probabilistic outcome. So it's not a very natural fit. So that question. You can define a class called EQP that's exact quantum polynomial time. You have to work really hard to make sure you don't have random outcomes of your measurements in quantum mechanics. And so it's not a very natural computational class. It's not studied very highly, and it doesn't seem a very important question. Okay, there's one last notion that I need to tell you about for complexity theory, and then I'm going to move over to physics. And that's the notion of reduction between computational problems. This lets us compare the difficulty of different computational problems. So, there's a poly-time reduction between two problems. So we say that A reduces to B. So A is a problem, say factoring. So not a specific instance, it's the whole, all of the factoring problems. So the problem of given some numbers, factor it, or a SAT problem. We say that, and B is another computational problem. We say A reduces to B if there's some map that's from A to B, such that to solve so that, let's say R between these problems, so that, let's write this informally, so that, I can solve problem B. There's a map R, and this, and it's important that this can, which can be computed, that's poly-time computable. Such that if B is a yes instance, sorry, if A is a yes instance, or a yes instance or a no instance, then I apply this map, and it preserves the answers. So probably made that too formal. But if I can take problem type of problem A, and I can do some polytime computation that turns it into an instance of this problem, then I say that this reduces to this. So what does this let me do? This says if I have this basically means if I have a black box, some box that can solve problem B, but what I want to solve is problem A, I just say okay, I can do some easy computation to turn it into a problem B type problem, use this box that solves B type problems and get the answer to the problem I want. Okay, so in this sense, this means that problem B is harder than problem A, because if I can solve B, that lets me solve A. Yeah.
So you need to map it both ways?
No. So if I have the mapping both ways, the problems are computationally equivalent. If I have the mapping just one way, then B is harder than A. So then we would write, you often see written B is bigger than. Of course, if I have B bigger than A and A bigger than B, then B is equal to A. Or bigger than equal, I should say, this is bigger than A. So this is the notion of reduction. So I can turn one problem type of problem into another problem. Then if I can turn problem A into problem B, then solving B is at least as hard as solving problem A. And captures that notion. Okay, and this lets me add a bit to this already complicated diagram. It turns out, and this is perhaps the most remarkable result in complexity theory, and it's kind of the starting point of this is why complexity theory developed into a whole theory, is that there turns out that there are problems that are so-called NP hard. So there are problems where every problem in NP can be turned into that signal problem. And the SAT problem that I wrote over there is an example of it. I can take any problem in NP, even one that's never been defined yet, that's not been written down before, and there's a way of turning it into an instance of the SAT problem. Such that if the original problem was yes, the answer was yes, then the SAT problem I convert it to will have the answer yes, and if the original problem had the answer was no, the SAT problem I convert it to will have answer no. So solving SAT is as hard as every other problem in NP. And this is called NP hard. So NP hard problems that are class of problems with reductions from all other. Well, let's write this. Let's use the notation I just wrote down. So problem A is NP hard implies that B. That A is given B for all B in NP. So any other NP problem can be turned into an instance of problem A. And then you'll see here the terminology MP complete. MP complete just means MP hard could be a problem that's not in MP, but everything in MP can be reduced to it. MP complete means it's both MP hard and in MP. And indeed, SAT is in fact NP complete, because it's in NP, and every other NP problem can be turned into it. Okay. Same analogous notions for all of the, for the other complexity classes. So you can have MA hard problems, you can have QMA hard problems, the same definition. Okay. My plan is now to switch to see how all of this can say anything about physics. Are there any questions before I do that? Okay, good. Everyone, either everyone's lost or you've asked all the questions.
Do these classes give you any power on sort of meta questions? That is, if I give you, if I have a problem in P, I know it's in P, I give it to you, but I don't give you the polynomial, I just give you the degree. I ask you to find the polynomial. Is that undecidable because the coefficients are unbounded?
I think probably, so if you give me, I mean, you're giving me the problem and you're saying,
I know it's in P.
I know it's in P, but you're not telling me what, you know.
I give you the degree of the polynomial, but I don't give you the polynomial.
So then I think that's sort of equivalent to saying, you're, you know, here's the problem, but I'm not telling you the algorithm. So if I can find an algorithm, you know, then it's down to me, can I find the algorithm for that problem? But I suspect that determining, I don't know, I'm not sure, it wouldn't surprise me if determining if a problem is in P or not might well be undecidable. It's at least certainly not obviously in P, but it might well be undecidable. In fact, I strongly suspect, yeah, I think it probably is by Weiss's theorem. Okay, so let's try and connect this to physics. And we sort of actually have sort of seen the first step towards that with SAT and the question about phase transitions. So I'm just going to talk about, there's a lot of things were done already in the 80s in classical StatMech and complexity theory and connecting those two. I'm not going to talk about any of that, but talk about the quantum, more recent quantum stuff. And recent means since 2000. So the core, the main question that's studied in Hamiltonian complexity is something called the local Hamiltonian problem. Not the only one, but it's by far the most studied. So what's a local Hamiltonian, just to make sure we're on the same page? I'm going to go a bit quicker through this. But I just have Hamiltonian on qubits, on, let's say, n qubits. Or it could be qdits, it could be spin, some finite dimensional spin. And it's a local Hamiltonian, means that it's a sum over local terms. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, let's say, write it like that. So Si is some subsets of k qubits, let's say. So this would be a k local Hamiltonian, is one that has that, can be decomposed as local interactions. Each interaction is on k particles. So unfortunately, the terminology was taken across from computer science. We call this k local. From a physics perspective, it would be much better to call this k-body, okay? Because there's no geometry assumed here, there's no particles being near each other, it's just that the interactions are k-body interactions in the Hamiltonian, and that's it. And it's on finite, I mean, I could make this q-dits rather than q-bits, but it's on finite number of finite dimensional spins. So here's a three-local Hamiltonian, okay? We say it's k-local if the interactions are at most k-body. Good. Or implicitly here, I'm tensoring with identity on the complement of that set. Okay, but we'll often drop that. Okay, so it's important to keep in mind that I'm not assuming any geometry at all on this. It's not on a lattice, it's just a bunch of particles. Okay. Then the local Hamiltonian problem is, this is going to be our first and only example of turning a physics problem into formulating it as a well-defined computational problem. The local Hamiltonian problem captures the problem of what's the ground state energy of the Hamiltonian. Okay. But we want to turn that into a well-defined computational problem so we can start asking complexity theory questions about it. So input Okay, local Hamiltonian. Okay, in principle, strictly speaking, the bit string describing, in some sense, some way that I'd have to choose. The details never matter. Some k-local Hamiltonian, or a description of k-local Hamiltonian, on n qubits with, let's say, m local terms. So I'm taking this sum I equals 1 to m. Okay. And then the output. So I'd like to formulate this as a decision problem, just so that I can connect it with all of these decision classes. And there's another, and then two parameters I need, to, and the, another part of the input, I'm given two parameters, alpha, beta, that are, let's say, real numbers. And there we go. Right, so, and with alpha smaller than beta. So output yes if the ground state energy of my Hamiltonian is less than or equal to alpha, and no if the ground state energy of my Hamiltonian is bigger than or equal to beta. Okay, and that's clearly, I've turned it into a promise problem. If I really want to know what the ground state energy is, I can just do binary search on alpha and beta and say, okay, is it here, alpha and beta, where is it? And then once I know, I can just search in that half and narrow things down. And I've left a gap here because there's another very important part, which is that the ground state energy is, of course, it's a real number. So I need to be careful that I could easily have problems that were undecidable if I really allow the problem that I've written here by just having alpha being an uncomputable number, for example. So we need to do an additional thing, which is to add in a promise that we promise that the ground state energy of is either smaller than alpha or bigger than or equal to beta, and it's not in between. So I'm promising that here's my energy, and here's alpha, here's beta, and I'm promising that my ground state energy is not in that region. Okay, and I'm also going to prompt now, I need that this is bigger than or equal to 1 over some polynomial in the number of qubits. Okay, so this is often confusing. I've made the problem easier by giving this extra promise. I'm not required to, it's not, when if you're faced with solving a local Hamiltonian problem, this promise, think of it as, if I don't fulfill the promise, if in fact my thing has ground state energy here, then I can output whatever answer I like, and that counts as correct. That's one way to think about it. Another thing about it is the problem of, if I'm giving you the problem, it's my task to make sure the promise is fulfilled. It's not your task. In when you're solving it, you can assume that that promise holds. Okay, so that's the definition of the problem. What we're going to prove in a moment, or not prove, but I'm going to explain, is that this problem is in fact complexity theoretically hard. It's in fact QMA hard. So this is a problem that we can prove cannot be solved efficiently, even on a quantum computer. So the fact that I've made the problem easier by giving this promise makes my result stronger. It says that a problem that's even a bit easier than you might have naively written down is still hard. But in fact, more importantly, we need this promise for this to be meaningful as a computational problem. Okay.
Doesn't that depend on the Hamiltonian?
I give you, as part of the input, these two numbers, alpha and beta. So I say, here's the Hamiltonian, here's alpha and beta. I promise you the ground state energy isn't between these two, and yes, alpha and beta, I can give you whatever numbers I like. And then your task is just to output yes or no, depending on whether it's here or here, the energy.
But, I mean, aren't there some Hamiltonians for which determining what calculating the ground state energy is
easy? Yes, of course. I mean, so there are factoring problems that are easy as well. For example, if I give you a power of 2, it doesn't matter how big the power of 2 is, right. It's an easy instance.
Right. So the statement that this is, in QMA...
It's in QMA and it's also QMA hard. Every QMA problem, in fact, can be turned into this. It depends on, the parameters of the problem are the Hamiltonian. So there
exists Hamiltonians for which it's QMA, and there's also Hamiltonians for which it's...
That's an important, I should have emphasized this a bit more in the talking about complexity theory. When I talk about computational problem, it's not one instance, it's the whole caboodle, right? The factoring problem is not factoring the number 15. The factoring problem is an algorithm for factoring any number. So this says that, the computational problem is the whole class of problems of this form. not just one instance.
So we're looking at the worst case
yes.
of a halo collapse.
Absolutely. So exactly. So it's a very good point. I should have said that. So complexity theory, at least what the basic complexity theory that I presented, is all about worst case. Yeah. You can ask questions about average case, typical case complexity. It's much harder. It's studied, but I'm not going to talk about it.
Are all these numbers finite, including m?
Yes.
So I shouldn't worry about dangerously irrelevant operators that you can...
Probably not, but now you're reaching the limits of my physics knowledge because I stopped being a physicist long ago. But I think, no. Yeah, M is, everything is finite here. Yeah, these are finite systems. Yeah.
So why is it called, why is it given separately as a promise and not just included in input? Is there a reason?
There's no easy way to, if I have a Hamiltonian, it's really hard to know whether this is true or not, right? I've got no idea what alpha and beta should be. So, in some sense, we punt that problem to the person setting the problem rather than the person answering it. This would be a strange thing to do if we were actually showing that this... If we had an algorithm for solving this promise problem, this wouldn't be very useful, because how do you make sure the promise is satisfied? But we're not going to be doing that. We're going to be showing that this problem is actually can't be solved easily. So that means that this promise is actually... It's meaningful. It doesn't really matter the fact that we've added this. But we have to add this for the problem to be a well-defined computational problem. Otherwise, we've got the problem that these are real numbers... The ground state energy is a real number. Really, I should probably change to be correct. I should change that to rationals to avoid problems with infinite. But if I don't do this, the problem is that determining whether a real number is bigger than zero or not is undecidable. Forget Hamiltonians. Just that problem is undecidable. But for stupid reasons, because we can have real numbers that are arbitrarily close to zero and, in fact, can be uncomputably close. So we want to avoid having silly answers like that, like this being trivially undecidable. And for that, we need to... And that's the kind of thing we often have to deal with in physics, because we're working over real numbers, and we've got these sort of... We want to rule out these kind of boring answers by defining the problem carefully so that those are not... So that we capture the essence of what we want to do physically, which is not about infinite precision or uncomputably small numbers or... Yeah.
So the only appearance of... Something polynomial is in this bound on beta minus alpha, right? Why couldn't that be an exponential function?
Then it would turn out that this problem is even harder and would be hard for a class called QMAX. There are some... So I can think of the size of the problem as being n here, the number of particles, number of qubits. As soon as I've done that... M is polynomial in N, because I said they're K local, so that M is at most N choose K, which is order N to the K, so that becomes polynomial. So everything is polynomial in N here, in my problem. So I can think of N as the size of the problem here. And then the other polynomials come in the complexity classes, so I can ask, is this solvable in polynomial time on a quantum computer, where polynomial means polynomial of the number of particles? Or not, as the fact is what we're going to show.
K enter, because I only see N here.
K is a K, it's a K local Hamiltonian. Oh. Okay, so my Hamiltonian only has K body terms. This is important, because if I didn't have a K local Hamiltonian, really the problem size, I can take N as a measure of the problem size, but formally the problem size is the number of bits to specify an instance of this. If I have a K local Hamiltonian, then I can specify it in a number of bits that's polynomial in N and K. Well, polynomial in N where K, with K as a constant, because I just write down each term separately as a matrix. If I didn't have a K-local Hamiltonian, but I had a Hamiltonian that could be on the whole particles, that wouldn't be, I couldn't, N would not be a good measure of the problem size, because I have 2 to the N matrix elements to write down. Exactly, and 2 to the N parameters to specify one of them. So now N would be a bad measure of the problem size, because N is now, the problem size is now exponential N, so we shouldn't be using N as a kind of substitute for the problem size when we run into that problem.
So just to make sure I understand, so we're thinking of fixing K to be some definite number which won't vary as n goes to infinity.
Let's say 2.
And M itself can be varying with n, but only polynomial is so.
I mean, as soon as I fix K to be a constant and n is the number of particles, then M is at most n choose K. So then I get for free that M is polynomial in K.
So assuming a spatial locality doesn't change the complexity?
It turns out not, but it took a while to get there to prove it. Okay, so let me then tell you what the what the sort of the main result in Hamiltonian, well, the first and most important result in Hamiltonian complexity is the one I've already advertised. So this is a result by Alexei Kitaev in around 2000. And it's simply that the local Hamiltonian problem is QMA hard. In other words, every other, in fact, QMA complete. But the one part I want to talk about is this part, the fact that every other problem in QMA can be turned into an instance of local Hamiltonian problem. And now, since those are problems we don't expect to be solvable efficiently, even on a quantum computer, this says that this local Hamiltonian problem of, and this is capturing the problem of, I want to approximate the ground state energy to polynomial precision. This problem is hard even for quantum computers. That doesn't mean that every Hamiltonian we can't find the ground state energy. There are, of course, some that are easy. For example, non-interacting systems, no problem. But certainly even more complicated things than that. But in general, the general problem for all Hamiltonians, in the worst case, we won't even be able to solve it on a quantum computer efficiently. Unless QMA is equal to BQP, which we don't believe. Okay, and this has all of these implications that I already talked about. So I think for me the most interesting, perhaps the interesting implication is not give up on this problem, but this says something very interesting about the physics of these systems. It says that something we already knew, which is we can have many-body quantum systems that have spin glass-like behavior, that they get stuck, if you cool them, they get stuck in metastable state for a long time. The ground states have interesting structure. This gives us a different angle on this, where you often, to prove that something really is a spin glass and has that behavior is very difficult to prove it rigorously, even though we have very good numerics and very good sort of physics insight into why it should be. This gives us a different angle on this, where we can actually prove that they behave like spin glasses, modulo complexity theory assumptions. So it's a different set of conjectures we have to make, but I think that gives us a different angle on that physics, which I think is very interesting. Okay, are there any, I'm not gonna say anything about how, no, maybe I'll say one thing about how this is proven. I'll give you just a hint of the idea of how this goes. Calling it even a sketch is exaggerating, but here's kind of the proof ideas. And the idea goes back to, essentially, it's an idea that goes back to Feynman's 1982-83 paper, where he first, there's a bunch of things in that paper. I mean, one of the things was the first positing the idea of a quantum computer in the first place. Another idea that's in that paper is encoding computation into Hamiltonians. And the idea is this. Feynman's idea, which then Kitaev took and elaborated and significantly developed, is to say, let's construct a system where the ground state has the following structure. Ground state looks like this. So I'm dividing my system into two parts. So this is a bunch of qubits. And this is a bunch of qubits. Think of this part of the system as being like a clock. So this is just some set of orthogonal states that indicate time. Okay, so let's simplify this. Let's make this Hilbert space just CT to T. And this just goes 0 up to T. And this part is we call this the clock. This is often called the clock register. This part of the Hilbert space is the computational register. This holds the state of my computer, my quantum computer, at time t. So what I have in superposition here is a superposition over the entire history of my computation, but in superposition. So Feynman's idea was we can encode computation into Hamiltonians by constructing a Hamiltonian such that this is the ground state. And Feynman, it's very easy to write down a Hamiltonian with this as the ground state. And the one that Feynman wrote down looks like this. Plus the emission conjugate, plus, and I need some terms that, Okay, I don't. You can look up this Hamiltonian, my note. And it's not, it's a relatively easy exercise to prove that the ground state of the unique zero energy ground state of this Hamiltonian is this one. Okay, there's sort of some intuition here. If I apply this operator, what does it do? If I applied this to this state, this term in the Hamiltonian increments the clock. This advances the computation by one step. Quantum computation is reversible. We see that because we need the Hermitian conjugate of this to make this Hermitian. So we have a term that decrements the clock and undoes one step of the computation, but that's fine. Quantum computation is reversible. And these kind of make sure that there are no other ground state, trivial ground states that mess things up. Okay. The thing about this Hamiltonian is it's totally non-local. Right? This acts on the entire system. So we might as well have not written down this Hamiltonian. We might as well have written down the projectron to the orthogonal complement of this. We would have achieved the same thing. But this was a very interesting, I mean, the reason that Feynman wrote down this Hamiltonian is also thinking about other things to do with this as well in that paper. But what Kitaev did in 2000 is to take this and construct a Hamiltonian that has the same ground state, but the Hamiltonian is local. It has k-body interactions, and Kitaev's original construction has k equal to 5. So Kitaev made this idea, so this, we call this the Feynman Hamiltonian. So Kitaev produced Kitaev Hamiltonian, is the same ground state, but now k-local with k equal to 5 in his construction. Okay, so now we have a local Hamiltonian where in its ground state it has the whole history of the computation encoded. Okay, from there to proving QMA hardness, at least in the intuition is not so difficult. What do we do? In the final time step here, so the state that's in the T psi T component of my ground state, of my superposition, so the final time step, imagine I code into this, the computation I actually put into this Hamiltonian is the computation that verifies witnesses for a QMA problem. Okay. Then, and we leave the input to that computation unconstrained. Then from the definition of QMA, if there exists a witness, that means there exists a configuration of spins in my system such that when I compute, it outputs 1. It outputs yes, the witness is valid. Okay, and whereas if there isn't any such witness, then there will be no configuration of states I can construct, where if I advance the computation correctly, I will end up with a state that outputs 1, up to probability 2/3. And then all I do is I take my Hamiltonian, and I add to it, let's say that it's the first qubit of this register that holds the... I put a projectron to 0 on the output qubit. That means that if the witness verifier rejects, the state picks up some extra energy. Whereas if there is a valid witness, then it won't reject and it won't pick up the energy from this term. That's the intuition. Proving that is more work, I mean, because you have to make sure that you haven't messed things up by allowing other ground states. Now, it could be that this is no longer the ground state. In fact, that's the case. But you can, with some effort, prove a separation so that yes instances have energy above some beta. Sorry, no, yes instances have energy below some alpha, which you can figure out what it is, and no instances have energy above some beta. But the intuition is this. The Hamiltonian forces the computation to be encoded in the superposition of the ground state, and then we just add a one-body term to the Hamiltonian that gives some extra energy depending on whether the verifier said valid or invalid. So that's as much as I'm going to say about the proof of Kitaev's theorem. For the details, I mean, the full proof is there. In fact, the only place it was originally published, I think, was in Kitaev's book. You can find essentially the same proof in my lecture notes and in various other places all over the archive. Okay. Are there any questions about this? Okay. Yeah? Here first.
And then you. Hey, are these qubits with fermions?
It's still QMA hard. There's a result by Schulk and Verstrate who proved that for the Fermi-Hubbard model.
Not maybe special data, but in terms of k-local fermion, is it similar?
Yes, is the short answer. It's still. I mean, you can prove QMA hardness for k-local Hamiltonians. I mean, k-body now has a different meaning, right? I can't just write it like that, but. But yes, for finite body interactions of fermions, you can prove QMA hardness of the ground state energy problem. Again, worst case.
What is known about the relative complexity for energies other than the ground state?
That is a very interesting question. So the maximum eigenvalue, of course, same thing, just flip things with a minus sign. Other than that, I'm not aware of, I don't know. Probably there, you can usually, like with sort of simple tricks, cook up things so that this will be the first excited state and I have some, and then you ask about the first excited state and what its energy is. Definitely you can do that. So that kind of, or the kth, dth excited state. So I can certainly, I can cook up a sort of simple construction that just puts some extra trivial energy levels below this one by modifying my Hamiltonian a bit and get hardness for those as well.
But the worst case might be even harder, right?
I don't think so. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so it will be QMA hard, but I haven't talked about the fact that this is in QMA, but that's true. So it'll still be hard, but it might not be. The local Hamiltonian problem is not only QMA hard, but it's actually in QMA. There is a witness I can give, a quantum witness. It's just the ground state. Okay, so in the very last few minutes, let me just try and take you through what has happened since Kitter's 2000 result of taking this. In some sense, there's been a whole dialogue between the physicists and the computer scientists of, I don't know whether this dialogue ever really took place except in the minds of people, but or over coffee maybe, but the way I like to think of the dialogue is that like Kitter comes along and says, okay, look, the ground state energies, we can prove that they're hard to compute, and then it's five body interactions, we don't have those in nature, and there's no geometry local, they're not local, so this result doesn't say anything interesting about physics. So then the complexity theorists come back and say, okay, we can do it with two-body interactions. So that was wrote by Kitev, Kempe, and Regev from 04. It's now two local. QMA hardness for two local interactions. Okay, but okay, still no geometry, and so the physicists are, okay, two-body interactions, very nice, but there's no geometry here, you know, we're interested in lattice systems. So, okay, Oliver and Ter Hull in 05 showed that it was still QMA hard for a 2D lattice, square lattice of qubits. And then I imagine the physicists saying, okay, but 2D, we know 2D systems are hard, right? I mean, we think that we need 2D for high temperature supergong activity, and we know 2D is complicated. But so we already knew this, it doesn't tell us anything new. But, you know, 1D, we know there's the DMRG algorithm, we can solve 1D systems, so, you know, you're just telling us what we already knew.
So are the two reasons it's hard the same? Quantum interactions is the reason it's hard from the normal physical point of view. So.
Indeed. I mean, and I said, this dialogue probably didn't, I'm sure if it happened, was at a much more higher scientific level than I'm presenting. But there was then a result that I really like is the, I mean, all of these are very nice results. So this one was kind of, Aharonov, Gottemson, Irani, and Kempe. There were good reasons to think that 2D could be complexity theoretically hard and 1D easy, because there are good algorithms in 1D, like DMRG. It's hard to prove that they're worst case polynomial time, but nonetheless, 1D systems seem to be different. But Aharonov, Gottemson, Irani, and Kempe then, in a result that at least, I mean, surprised quite a few people even in quantum information theory, showed that it was QMA hard even for 1D chains, nearest neighbor interactions in a 1D chain. No longer for qubits. Now, the local Hilbert space dimension is, I think, 13. I think they claim 12 in the paper, but it's actually, there's a small bug, and it's actually 13. Okay, nice. This is totally not, this was kind of surprising. This shows that you can have spin glass-like behavior in 1D. Which is maybe surprising, something we wouldn't have expected in physics intuition. But this system breaks translation invariance completely. It's not translationally invariant at all. The interactions between each nearest neighbors are different. In a really, really beautiful paper in 2009, these are the dates of the archive papers rather than the published version. Gottesman and Irani proved basically QMA hardness for translationally invariant systems in 1D. Which is almost as simple as you can get, really. We now just have a translation invariant spin chain, finite length spin chain, and it's still QMA hard. Okay, technically QMA exp hard, but it's a variant of QMA. But the physics implications are the same. You pay a price in that the local Hilbert space dimension is now, I don't know, they don't say in the paper, I did a rough estimate once, it's something like a million. So each particle is a dimension a million spin, something like that. One of my students, Johannes Bausch, together with myself and Marius Otsols, brought the same, had proved, recently brought this down to 42, I'm pretty sure that my student just smuggled in some extra dimensions to make it 42, but I couldn't figure out where in the proof he did this. This is very suspicious. This is not necessarily the limit. I mean, maybe you can bring it lower. Our goal is sort of say, okay, maybe is this really, does it have to be so crazily unreasonably unbig, or can you actually bring it down? It turns out with some new ideas you can really do, and I doubt this is the end of the story.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused about the D. So you have a qdit?
Yeah.
Does the D have one of them or just single one?
No, I have n qdits.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So n qdits, but now it's no longer spin half, it's spin.
Okay, so if you have d to the
d minus 1 over 2. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's sort of where we've got to in terms of one direction of trying to simplify, so prove QMA hardness for ever simpler systems that are ever closer to things that you might study in theoretical condensed matter physics. Another direction is to say this doesn't make the interactions here can be and don't have any special structure or symmetries. Another direction that's been studied is to say can we prove QMA hardness where we restrict what type of interactions are in our system? And again, I mean, I'm omitting a lot of the literature here. I'm not. This is not comprehensive. So, but at least just to pick out a couple, there's a paper by Biamonte and Love from 07, where they prove QMA hardness for a bunch of interactions on qubits, so XZ interactions plus XX, combinations of X and Z interactions, they prove QMA hardness for various Hamiltonians constructed only out of restricted types of interactions. And jumping ahead, the paper by myself and Ashley Montanaro, where we, in some sense, just ended the story for qubits, at least here, where we gave a complete classification of, given the type of two-qubit interaction, I can tell you what the complexity is of the ground state energy. And it turns into full, depending on the interactions, it's either in P, NP, a class that I haven't introduced called stock MA, or MA. And it necessarily falls into one of these classes, and we know the whole story for qubits now, for two-qubit interactions, so the simplest type of interaction. And I think I've pretty out of time, but the last thing I wanted to say is to connect this also to some, you can sort of think of, as well as hardness of local Hamiltonian problem, you can fit a lot of other results that aren't strictly speaking about complexity theory into this kind of, they make sense from this perspective. So just a couple I wanted to mention, and there's many, many more I could list here, but I'm out of time. So the result by Matt Hastings in 07, showing an area law for 1D gapped systems, the paper is the 1D area law for gap. And as well as this paper, what Matt also proved in this paper is that, I mean, from this, you can relatively easily get that there exists a good matrix product state description of the ground state of gap 1D systems. So there's class of states that can be parameterized efficiently in terms of a polynomial number of parameters, even though you've got n particles in an exponentially large Hilbert space. There's a complexity theory way of viewing that result. The fact that there's an efficient classical description of the ground state means that this problem is in NP. Because, okay, it doesn't say that I can find that ground state easily, but it at least says if there's a efficient classical description that I can compute the ground state of efficiently, which you can for matrix product states, then that's a proof that the problem, the local Hamiltonian problem, the ground state energy problem for this type of Hamiltonian, 1D gapped systems, is in NP. That's another way of phrasing that result. And then to finish that story, there's a paper by Zef Landau, Vazirani, Vidic from 2013, where they proved that there is an algorithm to find, efficient algorithm to find that ground state. And what does that do? That puts this problem now, efficient algorithm, so effectively a provably efficient version of DMRG, efficient algorithm to find the MPS. Well, that says that it's not just in MP. It means that it's actually in P. Okay. So you can see these results, which are not phrased in terms of complexity theory at all in the literature, but you can see those as they fit into this complexity theory picture. That's what another way of what they are showing us complexity theoretically. I guess since someone asked about decidability and undecidability, and since Fernanda foolishly gave me this opportunity to pontificate, I'll mention one result about undecidability because it's my own. But you can say some things about, I wanted to mention this as an example because all of the things I've talked about so far are all contingent on complexity theoretic conjectures that, you know, QMA is not equal to BQP. It all could potentially all fall apart because everything collapses down to P. We don't know. We don't expect it, but it could be. The nice thing with computability is we actually know if things are uncomputable, there's no conjecture. It's not contingent on any conjecture, it's just true. And what we proved, and which connects into this story, which is why I put it here, is we showed that given a Hamiltonian, but now we're talking about a Hamiltonian on a 2D lattice, nearest neighbor, but now we're talking about the thermodynamic limit. So we're really, now n is no longer finite, it's taken to infinity. And we showed that the spectral gap problem, so the problem of is it gapped or not, is undecidable. So in a sense, you can see this as another complexity, Hamiltonian complexity result, and indeed it uses a lot of tools from Hamiltonian complexity, and in particular this paper we drew heavily on that result. But this is an result of the other end of the scale in complexity theory, where we show that, okay, this problem is really not even decidable, it's outside the whole thing and can't be solved at all, and that's at least the result that's not modulo any complexity theoretic constructions. But it uses all of the same, it really very much is a Hamiltonian complexity result, even though in principle it's about computability rather than complexity. Okay, there's many, many more interesting papers that I've omitted here, and apologies if any of the authors are in the audience, but I think I'll stop there. And answer any more questions. Let's go to the back first, and then...
Just about the definition of the complexity in the case of 1D translation invariant nearest neighbor chain.
Yes.
It seems like the number of parameters doesn't depend on the length.
Yes. In fact, this result is more remarkable than I've presented, because the Hamiltonian is in fact fixed in this result. It's just a fixed Hamiltonian I can write down, and there's only one parameter left, which is the length of the chain. And they put the entire problem into the length of the chain. So what they do is, in a concrete sense, they, depending on the size of the chain, this thing is either computing, maybe for chain length 100, it's factoring the number 15. For chain length 101, it's solving a SAT problem. For chain length 102, it's running, simulating a quantum dynamics on a boson gas. The whole problem is specified just by how long the chain is, makes the computation that's encoded in the ground state in this Feynman-Kitaev way just be something completely different. The whole input is in the chain length. This actually, for sort of subtle technical reasons, means that the complexity of this is actually not QMA, but one level up in the complexity theory hierarchy. It's actually QMAX part. It's hard even on a quantum computer with exponential time at its disposal. I'm very happy to talk more, because that's quite of a deep technical question about that result. But you're absolutely right, and in fact, it's even more. It's not even that the local interactions are not part of the problem here. It's just one matrix that they write down. It's just that the whole problem, only parameter is the length, chain length. Yeah. You had a question here at the front, again?
Yeah. I was just going to ask on your last remark. What does it physically then mean that if the problem is undecidable?
So again, maybe this is because I am, in my heart of hearts, still a physicist. For me, the interesting implications are not so much give up on this problem. I mean, maybe this has a bit more of that implication, because it makes you start to wonder if maybe, I don't know, Yang-Mills mass gap is undecidable or something. But on a physics perspective, every time we have a sort of hardness result in complexity theory or computability theory, that tends to immediately have very interesting implications for what the physics of the system is, which is the part, I find very interesting. So in this particular result, we talked a bit about what the complexity theory says about the physics. Here, because of this, you can immediately get lots of interesting implications out of this for the physics. One is that if I take a finite piece of this Hamiltonian, and I look at it, of course I can tell whether it's gapped or gapless. Physically I could measure it and poke it. Maybe I find out that it's gapped, and then I grow the system a bit just to check, because, really we're talking about thermodynamic limit here, it still looks gapped. What this result implies is that at some point, it can look gapped up to some threshold, and then suddenly I add one more atom to the system, one more particle, and it becomes gapless. Or you can have the transition in the other direction. It looks gapless, the dense spectrum is becoming dense, and then suddenly it jumps and the gap opens. And there's no hint before you get to that threshold that something interesting is going to happen. And what's worse, the size at which it happens is an uncomputable number. So you can prove that you can never compute what the size is, even if you know all the interactions. And that's the kind of flavor of, for me, these are not just no-go results. They say, okay, you should always flip. There's always a flip side, which is it says that there's some very interesting physics going on. So that's what one thing you can draw out of that result. No. So this is, again, it's always worst case. So for this result, we constructed a specific Hamiltonian.
Okay, so your Hamiltonian is restricted to this area?
The Hamiltonian is, I mean, it's restricted in the sense it's a 2D translation invariant Hamiltonian on a square lattice. It's a horrendously complicated. I mean, you thought that 10 to the 6 was bad. This is like 10 to the 10 to the 10 or something. I mean, I don't know, but it's some huge dimension or local Hilbert space dimension. It's some fixed number. In principle, I could write down the entire matrix for the interactions. They're just two-body. But this is a horrendously artificial family of Hamiltonians that we use to prove our results. Again, this is a worst-case result. It says that for some Hamiltonians, this problem is unsolvable. It doesn't say that you can't solve it for everything, for anything. I mean, there's Hamiltonians where you can prove that it's gapped or gapless.
Yeah. I'm just a little curious about the role of the ultimate UV completion, which will introduce all sorts of irrelevant operators that
I'd really love to
make a difference, but they're there in physics. And,
so I'd like to, I mean, this is sort of, this is finite dimensional, local Hilbert space dimension. Everything is, you know, mathematically rigorously proven. I would really love to chat about this in the month I'm here with people about that kind of question, because I don't know the answer, what's going on if you think about it in an RG picture in this system. What goes on if you try and apply an RG flow to this Hamiltonian? It's a very interesting question I'm thinking about with a student, but I'd be very happy to discuss it. Sure.
Going back to the church,
yes.
So there are the ideas that the physical, the nature is such that it does not let you do better than certain complex class. So let's say before quantum mechanics was known, one could have written down laws of quantum mechanics on pen and paper without knowing such a thing exists or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a quantum church theory hypothesis which lets you do slightly bigger class of problems. But are there attempts to write down some new kind of something beyond quantum mechanics which let you do something harder classes? Okay. This is a theoretical thing which may exist somewhere, may not exist.
So, I mean, I'll answer that, and then I suggest I need a coffee anyway. But let me, I mean, there's a lot of questions there. So one is that the original Church-Turing thesis is not about complexity, it's about computability. So then the strong Church-Turing thesis is about not every model of computation is efficiently equivalent to the Turing machines. So if we talk about the strong Church-Turing thesis, then in some sense quantum computing strongly suggests that it's not true, the strong Church-Turing thesis, and there is reasonable models of computation, quantum mechanics, that can efficiently solve some problems that can't be solved classically. Of course, you just update the Church-Turing thesis to become the quantum Church-Turing thesis, which says that everything is polynomial time equivalent to a quantum computer now. People in computer science, some sort of corners of computer science study computation when you're dropping a computer down a black hole and then it's got Aleph zero computational steps and look at computability and complexity theory under those kind of models. It's a bit pushing the definition of reasonable, I think, to sort of think. But yes, people do think about these things. And I think there are results. As soon as you, I mean, I'm not an expert in that at all. As soon as you drop your computer down a black hole, I think you immediately can solve undecidable problems, no problem, because you sort of have infinite. I mean, at least if you, they construct some model of computation that's supposed to capture, somehow be motivated by what would happen if you had general relativistic effects. Right. So
closed-time-like curves, right? They like
closed-time-like curves. Closed-time-like curves, I think. It also have. It's not clear whether it's how reasonable it is. But yeah, I mean, people do think about it. Yes, it's somewhat niche, but it is. There is literature on it. Yeah.
If I take 1D system, if I replace 2D by 1D in this undecidability spectral gap, what is known about
data? In unpublished work by ourselves, we're pretty confident we can prove undecidability in 1D, but that's not.
So
that's not. Seems not, yeah. But I mean, that's modulo a lot of checking the proof is correct. Yes. That's still work in progress. We're reasonably confident we have a proof of that now. Last one.
I was hoping you could quickly comment. So you said these complexity classes are all worst case.
Yes.
You mentioned there's results and average, something like that. Especially if you're trying to relate, I mean, by relating these complexity classes to physics. I would imagine that because in physics we typically, you know, always ignore some small probability or, you know, do something like that.
Well, the interactions aren't exactly what you wrote down, they're slightly off.
Exactly. Or in thermodynamics, mm-hmm. right, you have to ignore some very improbable events.
Sure.
So I was hoping you could briefly comment on that.
It's a very hard question to pin down precisely what the question is. I think that's almost the hardest part. Because what do I mean by saying, like, a typical case Hamiltonian? Am I putting some probability distribution over all Hamiltonians? Am I putting some distribution over local interactions? What? So it's not very there's not a lot of work studying that. Just as, I mean, and then studying kind of average case, typical case, complexity questions. There is a whole field of typical case and average case complexity in classical computer science. It's just, it's harder to prove results than in the worst case, but people do. There hasn't been a whole lot of that in people looking at that quantum mechanically, a little bit, but not much. It seems it's quite difficult to A, precisely formulate what the right question is, in a sense that you can start analyzing it, and B, proving average case complexity results is really hard. Things that have been proven, I mean, what in the 90s in computer science was big is the PCP theorem, and that gave you results about hardness of approximation that said you can actually, like for the SAT problem or for a traveling salesman, getting close to the shortest path in the traveling salesman problem, getting reasonably close is easy, and then beyond some threshold it becomes hard. And that gave you access to methods of proving hardness of approximation, exactly how accurately do you have to approximate the answer in order to have something that's MP hard. And that kind of thing, there is some stuff on. And again, in quantum it seems quite hard to prove. So far we're a bit stuck on things like even proving like a quantum PCP theorem. That's not quite about errors in the Hamiltonian, but that's about not asking questions that are quite as like asking for the ground state energy to to 1/poly precision. That's quite a big ask, right? Probably I only really need one to care about it for a few digits. So there is work on that, but it's sort of not much of it yet. Okay, I think we should stop there and let everyone go for coffee.